Well, today we come to the famous Battle of Jericho. When Teresa was in youth group, she had a little teen choir that toured around and did some great stuff. And every once in a while, when we first got married, her friends would get together and sing the song, you know, Joshua fought the Battle of Jericho, and it was great fun. This is like, you know, every child's favorite Bible story. And so we come to this today in our Wars of the Lord series. So here's the story just to catch up with the Israelites. After the Israelites escaped from Egypt, they journeyed at a leisurely pace to Mount Sinai. In other words, they could have gotten there in about 10 days if they traveled hard, but they took 3 months. They camped at Mount Sinai for 10 months. It's where they got the Ten Commandments and the rest of the law. And then, number two, they traveled northeast 11 days from Mount Sinai to Kadesh Barnea. And that's about 80 miles south of Jerusalem. And they were supposed to be brave, but instead they doubted God and would not conquer the land. And so they were consigned to 40 years of nomadic wanderings. At the end of that 40-year period of time, the Israelites went up on the right-hand side of your map along the Dead Sea, conquering Amorite territory along the way. And then it came time for them to turn left, turn west, cross Jordan, and engage in the Battle of Jericho. The Israelite army was told by God to march without words, without explanation. Just march, go around the city of Jericho, which, by the way, is a 9-acre plot of land. Just go around once a day, don't say anything. But they did have their ram's horn trumpets, and they played those, that kind of majestic, eerie sound, and they're playing, but no words, no explanation. And then on the seventh day, they marched around the acreage 7 times, and they shouted, blew the trumpets, and the wall fell down. That's the story. Here's what it sounds like in Scripture. Came to pass when Joshua was by Jericho in chapter 5, that there stood a man across from him with his sword drawn in his hand, and Joshua went to him and said to him, "Are you for us or for our adversaries?" And the man said, "No, I'm not for you, and I'm not for your enemy. I'm for me. I'm God. Are you for us or for our adversaries?" He said, "No. But as captain of the host of the Lord, I have now come." And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshipped and said to him, "What does my Lord say to his servant?" And the captain of the Lord's host said to Joshua, "Loosen your shoe from off your foot, for the place on which you stand is holy." And Joshua did so. Now, chapter 6. Now Jericho was securely shut up because of the children of Israel. None went out and none came in. And the Lord, so the captain of the Lord's host wasn't just an ordinary person. It was the Lord himself. This is what we call a pre-incarnate appearance of Christ. This is Christ acting as the Lord in a way that Joshua can see and talk to. Now the Lord said to Joshua, "You shall march around the city once. Thus shall you do 6 days. 7 priests shall bear before the ark 7 trumpets of ram's horns. The 7th day you will march around the city 7 times. The priests will blow the trumpets, and it shall come to pass when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, all the people shall shout with a great shout, and the wall of the city of Jericho shall fall flat, and every man shall ascend straight up before him." So the rubble will fall outwards. It'll make a ramp. You just run up there and attack the city. Today, we have 2 main considerations when we look at this event. The first one is, God gets to decide which battles we fight and how we're going to fight them. That's up to God, not you and me. And the second big point here is that sometimes God requires us to do what sounds absurd. Really, you could imagine Joshua listening to this. "All right, we're going to march around the city. Got it. And don't say anything. Okay, got it. We're not going to, no explanation. Got it." And then at the appointed time, you're going to shout, and the walls are going to fall down. You can imagine Joshua saying, "Come again." Yeah, you're going to shout, and the walls are going to fall down. Okay, you lost me on that last one. Walls don't fall down because you shout. God gets to decide which battles we fight, Jericho, and he gets to decide how we're going to do it. So remember, you're going to march around 6 days. 7th day, you're going to march 7 times. You're going to blow the trumpet when it's really long and loud. You're going to shout and the walls will fall. And then you run up the rubble and attack the city. That's it. All right. Well, we know that the Lord has Jerichos for us to conquer. The Lord assigns us cities to conquer. Spiritual warfare goals that the Lord has on his blueprint for the earth, and we're supposed to do these things. We know he definitely wants us to fight against temptation, and we know he definitely wants us to fight against the lostness of the people around us, because there is so much lostness. Haven't you seen that in our political climate over the last year or so? So much lostness, right? And so these are the battles God has chosen for us. And you see that this is a battle against temptation. Remember our great spiritual warfare passage in Ephesians 6. We do not wrestle against flesh and blood, not normal people, but against princes, against powers, against the rulers of darkness. It's a dark world. And we're fighting against this temptation of darkness. And spiritual wickedness, it's not just darkness, it's wickedness, spiritual wickedness in high places. So take upon you the whole armor of God that you might be able to stand fast in the evil day. Darkness and wickedness and evil, it's all around us, and that's our fight. In 1 Timothy 6:8, having food and clothing, let us be therewith content. But they that wish to be rich fall into temptation and a snare, many foolish and hurtful lusts. And there's the love of money, which causes so much evil. And then at the end, fight the good fight of faith. You have to fight against these temptations. You have to battle your Jericho of temptation. In 1 Timothy 1:18, this charge, this command, I commit to you, Timothy, according to the prophecies which went before over you. People say you have to fight. You have to be a captain, a leader in the church. Hold faith and a good conscience. War a good warfare against your Jericho of temptation. 2 Timothy 2:3, therefore endure hardship. It'll be hard to stand fast for Jesus, but endure hardship as a good soldier. No man that wars entangles himself with the affairs of this life. Don't be so attached to this world that you forget there is another world. There is an eternity that's more important than this temporary time. We know we're supposed to fight against the lostness of the people around us. Temptation in this hand, lostness of the people around us in this hand. Again, we were looking in Ephesians 6 about the powers of darkness, powers of wickedness, an evil time. You have to help people. It's a bad time. In 2 Corinthians 10:3, Paul says, we walk in the flesh, but we do not war along the lines of the flesh. The weapons of our warfare are not fleshly, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds. And what are we going to do with this lostness all around? Well, we're going to go and we're going to talk to people. We're going to show them, casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. Not just our own tempting thoughts, but to help others bring their thoughts into captivity, obedience for Christ. And so that's your Jericho. Temptation, the lostness of the people around us, that's your Jericho. You have to fight. The problem is, sometimes we are too quick to assign ourselves to our own fights. And sometimes these are social causes. Sometimes Christians get so involved with fights that are not your Jericho. It's not what God chose for you. It could be something like immigration laws and border crossings. We're all up in arms about this. This is not your Jericho. It could be COVID, masks, and vaccines. We're all upset. This is not your Jericho. Don't worry about that stuff. Fossil fuels and climate change. That's not your Jericho. Don't worry about it. Gender policies. What are we going to do with the restrooms? And what are we going to do with the pronouns? Don't worry about it. That's not your fight. Don't even bother with that. Class divisions. What about the shrinking middle class? And what's going to happen with a huge welfare underclass? And all these things. It's not your Jericho. Second Amendment rights. What are we going to do about gun rights? And what are we going to do with the police? It's not your Jericho. For the most part, don't worry about it. You know, believers in the Soviet era had to learn early on that they really didn't have a place at the table when it came time for negotiating much of anything. In those days, the churches were meeting in the woods or in barns or in secret locations. In those days, the people would come to church one by one. They wouldn't all come at the same time, and they wouldn't all leave at the same time. They staggered their arrivals and departures, so no one knew that there was a house church meeting here at this farm. They didn't want to look like it's a group, a gathering. They whispered their hymns. They couldn't make a lot of noise. They literally whispered, come on now, let's sing Amazing Grace. How sweet the sound. That's how they sang. and they hid their Bibles. You think, no, we're going to fight. This is our Jericho. And they knew they didn't even have a place at the table of negotiation on any of those things. They had to fly under the radar. And sometimes you have to quit fighting. It's not your Jericho. Just give it up. Fly under the radar. In the New Testament, I know you can't see this very well. Once again, I'm just trying to show you there's a preponderance of evidence that the Bible expects Christian people to be a persecuted minority. You think, no, I want a place at the table. I don't want just any place at the table. I want a big place at the table. I want to make the world listen. But Jesus always presented the church as a persecuted minority. You may not have any place at the table at all, and you have to get used to that. In Matthew chapter 5, blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake, and blessed are you when men shall insult you and persecute you and say all manner of evil things against you falsely for my sake. That's just the way it's going to be if you follow me. You don't have a place at the table. You are a persecuted minority. In Matthew 10, I send you forth as sheep in the midst of wolves. You're like sheep, and you're in a wolf world. That's so dangerous. Beware of men, they'll deliver you to the councils, courts. And they will scourge you, they'll beat you in their synagogues. And you'll be brought before governors and kings for my sake. And you'll be hated because of me. The church should expect to be in every generation a persecuted minority. And if there's ever a generation where we have a place at the table, that's just great. But we didn't require it, and we really didn't expect it. In Matthew 24, they will deliver you up to be afflicted, and they'll kill you. And you should be hated of all nations for my name's sake. In Acts 14:21, the apostles return confirming the souls of the new Christians, the disciples, and exhorting them that they must through much tribulation enter the kingdom of God. It's going to be hard to follow Jesus. Philippians 1, unto you is given on behalf of Christ not only to believe on him, but also to suffer for his sake. You're going to be a persecuted minority. Get used to that. In 1 Thessalonians 3:4, indeed, when we were with you, we told you before that we should suffer tribulation, even as it came to pass. And you know it, because they did suffer tribulation. They were a persecuted minority. 2 Timothy 3:12, yes, and all that will live godly in Christ Jesus shall suffer persecution. You might not have a place at the table. You might be fleeing. 1 Peter 4:14, if you are insulted for the name of Christ, and you will be, if you are insulted for the name of Christ, you're happy, for the spirit of glory in God rests on you. Revelation 2:10, fear none of those things which you suffer. The devil will cast some of you into prison. You'll have tribulation. Be faithful unto death, and I'll give you the crown of life. You are a persecuted minority. You have to get used to that, and don't hate it. It's what we expected. Revelation 6:9, I saw under the altar the souls of them that were slain for the word of God, and they cried with a loud voice, saying, how long, O Lord, holy and true, do you not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth? You see, from Matthew to Revelation, the New Testament expectation is not that we are going to be the dominant force in the world, but that we Christians are going to be a persecuted minority. It is our expectation from Jesus himself, and we shouldn't hate that. Sometimes we fight unnecessary Jerichos, unnecessary social causes, and sometimes we just pick battles because they are personally interesting to us, and these are not our Jerichos either. We think, I have to get another educational degree. Who says so? Did God say so, or are you making that up? It's not your Jericho in some cases. Must fight for more income and admiration. Who says so? Did God make that your Jericho, or are you making that your Jericho? Because there's a big difference. I must fight for grand opportunities for my child. My child has to be able to go to a top-flight school. I must fight for that. Why? Did God make that your Jericho, or are you making that your Jericho? You have to let God decide what you fight for. I must fight to fund this luxury or this hobby that I love. I will travel no matter what it takes. I'll fight for it. Why? Are you sure that's your Jericho? You have an expensive hobby. Are you sure that's the fight God wanted you to wage? I must fight to become more beautiful. I have to, get some work done. I have to, get some muscles on this frame. I have to work at it. Why? Who says so? Did God say so? Is that really your Jericho? Because maybe we're choosing Jerichos that God is not choosing. Ian Thomas was so good. He said, it's like God is telling us this. You cannot have my life, my strength, You cannot have my life for your program. You can only have my life for my program. I'm going to help you. I'm going to make you strong. I'm going to make you special. But not for your Jericho. I'm going to make you special for my Jericho. I'll help you be special when the fight comes that I assign for you. It's very important that we get this right. So God gets to decide which battles we fight and how we're going to carry out the fight. And the second big idea here in our story is that sometimes God requires us to do what sounds absurd. So, march around the city once each day. And the seventh day, you march around the city seven times. The priest shall blow the trumpets, and all the people shall shout with a great shout, and the wall of the city shall fall down flat, and then everybody run up and conquer the city. That's absurd. You can shout till you're green, and the walls aren't going to fall. Lord, I think I ought to know. Absurdity is part of the Christian life. Once again, you're going to have to get used to that. All the people shall shout with a great shout, and the wall of the city shall fall down flat. Here's how we sound when we're skeptical. We say, yeah, right. That'll never fly. Lord, let me help you out here. It doesn't matter how many of us shout and blow trumpets, the wall is not going to fall. And by the way, the walls of those cities were sometimes so wide that you could drive chariots on them. This is a substantial wall. Yeah, right. That'll never fly, Lord. We had a friend in our church, that dog won't hunt. I can tell you one thing, that's not going to work. That dog will never hunt. And we say, good luck with that. You're going to shout and the walls are, good luck with that. Or we say, let me know how that goes. That's absurd. That's never going to work. And the trouble is, the Lord is going to ask you to fight your Jerichos with a layer of absurdity all the time. A.W. Tozer is so wonderful this way. I reworked him just a little bit, but this is what A.W. Tozer says. The Christian believes that he has sacrificed his whole life, and yet he's more alive than before, and he fully expects to live forever. Though born on earth, he finds he is not really at home here and does not fit well into the ways of the very society into which he was born. The Christian soon learns that he must not follow the common pattern of mankind. That he may be safe, he puts himself in jeopardy. He loses his life to save it and is in danger of losing it if he attempts to preserve it. He goes down to get up. If he refuses to go down, he's already down. But when he starts down, he's on his way up. He may be highest when he feels lowest and most sinless when he is most conscious of sin. He sometimes does most by doing nothing and goes furthest when standing still. He fears God, but is not afraid of him. In God's presence, he feels overwhelmed and undone. Yet there is nowhere he'd rather be. He knows that he has been cleansed from his sin, yet he regards himself as the chief of sinners. He loves supremely one whom he has never seen. Being fully aware that he's a pauper, he talks familiarly with one who's the King of Kings. He feels that he is nothing, yet he believes he is the apple of God's eye, and even that Christ loves him unto death. He cheerfully expects before long to enter that bright world above, but he's in no hurry to leave this world. He's both a confirmed pessimist and a bright-eyed optimist. He knows the judgment of God is coming, and he rejects every human hope outside of Christ. But he is calmly, restfully optimistic in the knowledge that the end of his story is grand. That incredible Christian. It's absurd. Almost every line of A.W. Tozer's quote there is absurd. I mean, why would anybody act that way? Why would anybody believe that? And the Lord always, I put there sometimes and in parentheses, actually almost always, requires to do what sounds absurd. So, Jericho, all the people will shout with a great shout, and then the walls will fall down. Oh, they will. Well, let me know how that works out. Of course, it worked out just fine. But it sounds absurd. And you know what else is absurd? That normal people like you and me would give away something like $300,000 in the course of our lifetime to the Lord's work. That's crazy. $300,000, you know, that's house money. But that's what happens. A lot of you are giving like $500 a month to the Lord's work. And if you do that over the course of your adult life, let's say 50 years as an adult, you've given away $300,000. Now, you talk to a financial planner and say, yeah, you know, I make this amount of money, and over the course of my life, I'm going to give away essentially a house. And you can imagine an unbelieving financial planner saying, yeah, well, let me know how that works out for you. And the answer is, it's going to work out just fine. Say, that's absurd. The amount of money you make, you can't give away $300,000. That's absurd. Well, what'd you see about that? The Lord asks us to schedule our lives around Christian gatherings. What? Church? Didn't COVID teach us that we don't really need to go to church? And besides, it's not just church. It's all these Christian people taking care of one another. And we're supposed to schedule ourselves, or our kids' sporting events, our music, our hobbies. We're going to schedule our lives around Christians and Christian gatherings. That's absurd. I'll schedule my life around the things that interest me. That's what we'd want to do. So R.G. Letourneau, he's a very wealthy man, but he's supposed to be churning out earth-moving equipment back in the days before Caterpillar. And Letourneau products were like the road graders and the cranes and the excavators that made America. And so he is back there in the World War II era, and he realizes that he has told his shop foreman to produce a control unit for one of these tractors tomorrow. He says, it's okay, because I'm going to go home tonight. I'm going to sit down and design it, and I'm going to draft it out on the blueprint, and I'll have it for you when you come in the morning and get to work on the control mechanism. The only thing is, he gets home, he thinks, oh no, I'm supposed to be leading a Christian boys club at church today, and they love R.G. Letourneau. Can't just ask for a substitute. They want R.G. They're counting on him. Okay, Lord. Off he goes to this church gathering for the boys who are counting on him, and he's done with his Christian boys club. He goes back home, and the idea just comes to him at home, and in a few minutes he has his blueprints, takes it to the shop. Shop guys make it, becomes part of his tractor. Year later, his salesmen go to this convention. And at the convention, they see their competition. They come back and report to RG. You know, so how do we look compared to our competition? The sales guys are all excited. They said, we're doing fine. He said, it's our control unit. It's so sensitive. It's so easy to use. It's so accurate. And the other machines can't compare. A unit he put together in a few minutes after he scheduled his life around Christian gatherings. That's absurd. You're making tractors. You have to give this first place. No. You give your Jericho first place. The rest we'll figure out. Reach out to the most unlovely people you've ever known, and you forgive those who have harmed you the most. Reach out to unlovely people. Forgive the injurers. Yeah, good luck with that. Let me know how that works out for you. That's a crazy way to approach life. Is it? So, it's 1947. World War II has been over for 2 years. Corrie Ten Boom, of course, survived Ravensbrück concentration camp. She is now traveling in defeated Germany 2 years after World War II. They're still in a bad way. She's in Munich, and she's telling the people about God's forgiveness because they've lost a battle and they need forgiveness. And she says after she gives these lectures about God's forgiveness, the German people stand up and they don't say one word. There are never any questions. They're just ashamed. They lost the war, and they know they were wrong. They were cruel, they were vicious, and they know they're wrong. And they all stand up and they just leave silently because they know how awful they've been. Well, this time, this guy comes forward. She sees him coming forward, and she realizes that he is one of her guards. He doesn't remember her, but she remembers him from Ravensbrück. And he says, Fraulein, it's wonderful what you said about our sins being buried in the depths of the deepest sea. That's a wonderful thing. And he says, you mentioned Ravensbrück in your talk. I was a guard there. Of course, she knows. In her imagination, she can see him wearing his cap with the skull and crossbones, and he has a crop whip dangling from his belt that he used on the prisoners. I mean, she knows him very, very well, but he doesn't know her. And by the way, she's a little insulted that he doesn't remember her. You mentioned Ravensbrück in your talk. I was a guard in there. But since that time, I've become a Christian. I know that God has forgiven me for the cruel things I did there. But I would like to hear it from your lips as well, Fräulein. Again, he stuck his hand out. The first time he stuck his hand out to shake her hand, she acted like she was busy getting something out of her purse. And he eventually put his hand down. But now he sticks out his hand again. He says, "Will you forgive me?" And Corey says, "I wrestled." And by the way, remember Corey's sister, Betsy, died at Ravensbrück. "I wrestled with the most difficult thing I ever had to do. Jesus, help me," I prayed silently. "I can lift my hand. I can do that much. You supply the feeling." And so woodenly, mechanically, I thrust my hand into the stretched out hand of the guard. And as I did, an incredible thing took place. The current started in my shoulder. It raced down my arm, sprang into our joined hands. And then this healing warmth seemed to flood my whole being, bringing tears to my eyes. "I forgive you, brother, with all my heart." And for a long moment, we grasped each other's hands, the former guard and the former prisoner. And here she says, "I had never known God's love so intensely as I did then." Wow. So you're just going to forgive the people who have hurt you? You're just going to reach out with special compassion to the most unlovely people we know? Well, good luck with that. How's that going to work out? And she says, "Actually, I'd never known God's love so intensely as in that moment." That works out just fine. So that's absurd. There's almost always a layer of absurdity to the Jericho you have to fight. To be deeply thankful when God sends you correction, pruning, or suffering to showcase your loyalty. I have heard that one person actually quit coming to our church because I taught this lesson that no matter what happens to you, you should be thankful. Of course, I didn't just teach it. I'm repeating the Bible, right? Be deeply thankful when God causes you to suffer. See, that is absurd. I'll be thankful for 10,000 other things, but I am not going to be thankful for suffering. You just have to be off your rocker to do that. That's absurd. There's almost always a layer of absurdity when we're marching around Jericho and we're going to yell and the walls are going to fall. You know, well, that dog won't hunt. Ann Voskamp. My family had closed its hands to God because her 18-month-old sister was walking in the driveway and a farm truck ran over her. My family had closed its hands to God. No benevolent being, no grace, no meaning to it all. But these aren't things you need to say out loud anyways. Her family never talked about it. These aren't things you need to say out loud anyways. Like all beliefs, you simply live them. We did. I had nightmares as a child. I was terrified of death. I was diagnosed with an ulcer by the time I was 7 in grade 2. By the time I was in my teen years, I was cutting. By the time I was 18 or 19 years old, I was diagnosed with agoraphobia, fear to leave the house, basically. Agoraphobia and panic attacks. The world was a terrifying place for me where there was not only diagnosis and suffering, but a really violent death could slam against your face at any moment. And I'd planned my suicide for a Friday. She's in a pretty bad way, you know. And then she decides to listen to the gospel. She says, "So for me, it's really been trying to process anxieties and fear and suffering and pain. And what do you do with these things? One of the things I was really looking at was fighting that fear and anxiety and suffering. Can I give thanks in everything, through everything? Can I?" And here's what she said as she got better. "If I see God seeping up through all things, then can't I give thanks for anything? The practice of giving thanks is the way we practice the presence of God. Thanksgiving is the evidence of our acceptance of whatever He gives. Thanksgiving is the manifestation of our yes to His grace. As long as thanks is possible, then joy is always possible. Do I really smother my own joy because I believe that anger achieves more than love? Why else get angry? isn't it? Because I think complaining, exasperation, resentment will bring me the full life I really want when I choose, and it is a choice, to crush joy with bitterness. Am I not purposefully choosing to take the angry way of Lucifer because I think it's more effective, more expedient than giving thanks? Humbly let go. Let go of trying to do. Let go of trying to control. Let go of my own way. Let go of my own fears. Bend the knee and be small and let God give what God chooses to give, because He only gives love. And whisper a surprised thanks. This is the fuel for joy's flame. So how did that work for her? Well, before her extreme thanks, you know, that's absurd, right? Before that, we're talking about ulcer, self-cutting, agoraphobia, panic attacks, prescriptions, and detailed plans for a suicide. What happens after she decides to do this extreme thanks? Well, she's emotionally well. She's a successful wife and mother of six. She's a popular women's conference speaker. She's a best-selling author of the book, 1,000 Gifts. Yeah, oh, you're going to give thanks when you're suffering, huh? Well, let's just see how that works out. Let me know how that works out. Good luck with that. All right, I'll tell you how it works out. It works out really, really well. You say, that's absurd. You say, yeah, Jericho usually has a layer of absurdity to it. Give up your reputation at work and in society, your finances, your luxuries, and even your health for the pleasure and reputation of God in the world. I'm going to give all these things up for the pleasure and reputation of God in the world. Ha, that's absurd. Good luck with that. It does work out pretty well. Chuck Colson was a good friend of Jack Eckerd of, you know, the Eckerd drug stores. For a long time, Colson pestered him about becoming a Christian. Jack Eckerd never would. But one day, he did become a Christian. He went into his own drugstore as he's noticing for the first time, although, I mean, it's always been there. He just didn't care. He's noticing all these pornography magazines in his drugstore. And the thought occurs to him, why do we have these here? He's a Christian now. So he called his president of the corporation. He says, take Playboy and Penthouse out of all my stores. And the president said, you can't mean that, Mr. Eckerd. We make $3 million a year on those magazines. And he said, take them out. So 1,700 stores are now suddenly without pornography. Chuck Colson heard about what he did. He called Jack Eckerd on the phone. He said, Jack, did you do that because of your commitment to Christ? He said, why else would I give away $3 million? The Lord wouldn't let me off the hook. And by the way, he told some of his business friends who also owned chains of drugstores, he said, I took these out of my store. Why don't you take them out of yours? And they did. Pretty impressive. Just like that. Say, that's absurd. You're making $3 million a year. You're going to risk your finances on the reputation and pleasure of God? He said, yeah, I will. I don't have time to tell you about Eric Little again. Some of the details are so interesting. And I guess I still have to tell you about Rosaria. Last week we talked about Rosaria Butterfield. Here's another part of her story that I love very much. Remember, she's my wife's age. She's a professor of English and Women's Studies at Syracuse University in New York. She is a lesbian activist. She said, I very much thought, this is who I am. And this is how I want to live. I lived as a lesbian activist. I was terrified to affiliate on any level with a worldview that called me, my life, my community, my scholarly interest, and my relationship sin. She was talking to her friend Jay, who was transgendered by, prescription castration, if you will. He said, Rosaria, this Bible reading is changing you, and you need to tell me what's going on with you. I'm worried I'm losing you. She said, I sat down and had that panic feeling you have when you're not really sure if you're going to throw up. I said, I'm reading the Bible, reading it a lot. And what if it's true? We are in big trouble if it's true. And Jay sat down and said, I know it's true. I was a Presbyterian minister for 15 years. Well, you can't just give that up, right? I mean, that's absurd. She says, I was thinking, do I want to be changed? No. I like my life. I like my girlfriend. I like my house. Thank you very much. I even like my wonderful career. I woke up one morning emerged from a bed that I shared with a woman, got in my truck with my immoral bumper stickers and my butch haircut, and showed up at the church. Every layer of my life had so many idols attached to it. It was the idol of feminism, lesbianism, tenured professor, research, students, and books. Was I willing to be considered stupid by those who didn't know Jesus? I would go up to my Christian mom friends and say, "Look, if I become a Christian, I have to give up my girlfriend. What did you have to give up to be here?" When the Lord calls someone to obedience out of a life of sin, that's going to hurt a lot of people. It just is. A lot of people were hurt by my obedience. What I say about my conversion is I lost everything but the dog. That's absurd. You can't give up these things for the pleasure and reputation of God in the world. That will never fly. How is that going to work for you? And of course, it worked out just fine. Now she's a pastor's wife and doing very well. You can give up your reputation, your finances, your luxuries, even your health if necessary, to tell the gospel to people who don't even want to hear it. Why are you going to do that? They don't even want to hear it. So I close with this wonderful story. In the late 1800s, there's a pastor named Louis Albert Banks. And he went to a small community as the pastor. And right across from his church, remember, you know, this is a different world, right across from his church is a place of business that is known for its crude, immoral associations. It's right across from the church building. So the ladies from the church and the young girls from the church walk out the front doors of the church, and the men across the street are doing catcalls and all this mockery stuff. Same thing with all the Christians. They're mocking the Christians coming in and out of church. And this goes on for years. Well, he hasn't been there for years. He's new to the community, but this has been going on for years. And the thought comes to his mind, you know what we really need to do? I mean, this is my ministry. This is my Jericho. They are right outside the church doors. They're my people. So he tells his friends at church, here's what we're going to do. I am going to go evangelize that place of business. And there's one man in particular. He's the supervisor. And he's got a great sense of humor. Everybody loves him. But he's a bad guy. I mean, he hates God. And when he makes wisecracks, everybody laughs. You know, it's always very funny. So he tells his friends at church, you pray for me, because I'm going to start going over there for a few minutes every day and talking to those guys and getting to know them. And so that's exactly what happens. And for weeks, he goes over every day. And every time he walks in, especially the supervisor, has some dirty, cruel thing to say about him getting out of there. You know, he doesn't belong there. But he goes and he chats and he challenges the men. And so he does that. About 3 weeks after he starts doing that, the supervisor's wife comes to the pastor's house, knocks on the door and says, you have to come back to my house with me right now. And, of course, there are no telephones in this day. He said, why? And she said, my husband, there's something wrong. He's pacing back and forth like a caged animal, and he's all upset. It has something to do with religion. So Pastor Banks runs over to the house, and sure enough, it's just like the wife said, this man is all upset. And here's what he says. I knew better, too. But I've hated God and I hated you. And I've abused the members of the church and I've picked flaws in them. And I've made fun of every man that has started to be a Christian. And I have done all I could to keep them back when they wanted to come to church. And I fear some of them will be lost because of what I've said. Well, that day, that man became a Christian. As soon as he became a Christian, he started telling people about the gospel. And because he was so well-liked, you know, he's a man's man, he has a great sense of humor, and he said, I so regret the way I treated God and the followers of God. And pretty soon, 25 of his friends, men, had become Christians, and then with the men, their families have come to Christ, and all of a sudden, Pastor Banks' church is growing by leaps and bounds. It was uncanny. All right, so both Pastor Banks and the supervisor move away, and the years go by. Pastor Banks is asked to do some guest speaking at another city. He looks out over the congregation, and who's there but his old friend, the supervisor from the business of ill repute. And the guy's sitting right there. Pastor Banks says, I'm so glad to see you. And the man said, yeah, I live in this city, and you have to come and spend the night at my house. Pastor Banks says, well, there's no need, because my train leaves at 2:30 in the morning. I can't sleep tonight. I just have to stay up till 2:30. And the man said, no, you have to count on me. He said, there's something weird about me. I can wake up anytime I want to. I will not fail you. You come and sleep in my house for a couple hours, and I will wake up, and you'll catch your train. I'll see to it. So Pastor Banks says, all right. And that's the way it is. So sure enough, Pastor Banks goes to sleep at the appointed time. The man wakes him up, gives him some coffee all ready to go. And Pastor Banks looks at him and says, look here, you've been sitting up all night. You didn't go to sleep. You've been sitting up all night. I can see by your eyes that you have not been asleep. You're too old a man to do a thing like that. And he said, Pastor Banks says, I shall never forget the answer. His lip quivered, his eyes filled with tears. And as the great drops rolled over his cheeks, he said, you do not know what a joy it is for me to do something for you. If I were to sit up all night, once a week, as long as I live, it would be nothing compared to what you've done for me. So Pastor Banks one day says to his church, what we're going to do is we're going to go and we're going to lead that man to the gospel. And everybody says, that dog won't hunt. Let me know how that turns out. Not that man, maybe 10 other men, but not that man. You will never lead him to the gospel. But they all prayed. Next thing you know, he's a Christian. Say, that's absurd. That will never work. Except it does work. And so here's your conclusion. God, not you, not me, God gets to decide which battles we fight and how we're going to fight them. And part two of that is almost all the time, some part of your battle is going to sound absurd, and that's okay, because here's what happened at Jericho. The people shouted a great shout, and the wall fell down flat, and they conquered the city. And that's how your Jericho will go too, if you'll listen to the Lord.